All right. Good morning, guys, and thank you all for coming. It's a great privilege to be here. I want to start with three things which I managed to forget to put on the PowerPoints, which will come up in a minute. Number one is last week in contact, whoever wrote it on the front described me as a husband, a father, a lawyer, and an ethicist. Three of those things are true. I'm not an ethicist. I'm not an ethicist bootstrap. I'm a guy who thinks ethical issues are important and worries about them. That's as high as I would put it. So when Doug said to me, "Now, Mark, you don't want to go in over the top here and make these guys feel inadequate," I said, "Doug, there's no prospect of me making these guys feel inadequate." But I think ethics is very important. And here's the key message for the day. So if you go to sleep after this, I'm an evening biorhythm person. This is not my optimal time of the day. So I'll give you the key message now in case you're like me. The key message is Micah 6:8. What does the Lord require of you, O man? To do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. And that is a really good filter for running ethical or other decisions you have to make in life. And it's easy to remember. What is the just thing to do? You've got to unpack all these things, but it's a really good start. What is the just thing to do? What is the loving thing to do? And what would God want me to do? If I'm walking humbly in an intimate relationship with God, how does God form my character and how does God want me to act in this situation? And Christian ethics is all of those things. So I'm going to start in a moment or two with a description about the sort of ethical theories. What's good, what's right, what's just, how do you work that out? And that's sort of the clear thinking end of the spectrum. To think about, do you look at whether something is good because it has good consequences or because God or the law tells you it's good or because the person doing it is virtuous? That's helpful. It's helpful to understand where your thinking is coming from, where someone else's thinking is coming from when they say, you ought to do this, it's right because da-da-da-da-da. So there's about 10 minutes of theory here, guys, which I wouldn't appreciate if I was you at this hour of the morning, but I'm figuring since you've come to a men's breakfast, you clearly have morning biorhythms and you'll be raring to go. Bring it on. Okay. So there's 10 minutes or so of ethics around that area, but please remember, put that in the context of what I've said to you. The key message is Micah 6:8. What does the Lord require of you? To do justice, love mercy, to walk humbly with your God. Because we can have all the ethical theories in the world, but if we're not in intimate relationship with Christ, if we're not being formed in his character, then we're not plugged into the source of all wisdom and the source of love. And that's where an ethic greater than our understanding, a love and a wisdom greater than our understanding will come from. Okay, so I say that now in case I forget to say it later, but hopefully I'll remember to say it later. So where we're going to go this morning is I'm going to do a bit of a theory of ethics, and then I've got a few case study discussions. And I'm just going to let you break you up into groups to just turn around your seats where you are to talk through each of those. And then maybe we'll unpack them a little bit at the end. In some of these, there aren't right answers. Yeah, Christian ethics, any form of ethics is difficult. There are competing views. There are many different aspects to it. My aim this morning is to get you thinking in an ethical framework, to start to develop an ethical framework, to test the ethical frameworks you already have, to test the ethical frameworks other people come at you with, and to start to work together towards an ethical framework. I have some books, not for sale, but some books that I can show you that will help you on the path. There is also, and I may forget to say this at the end, so I'm going to say it now, there's also a 4-week study course for small groups which has been put together by the Centre for Applied Christian Ethics at Ridley College, which would be a really good basis for doing further study in a small group on ethics. And I would be happy to facilitate such a group if there was enough interest. I mean, if you want to do it in your own small group without me, that's fine. But if you'd like to do a group on ethical discussions working through those 4 weeks, then I'd be happy to be involved in that as much for my own benefit as for anyone else. Okay. So shall we just pray and then I'll start. Lord our God, we thank you for this day. Thank you for the gift of life that you have given us for another day. Thank you for our minds and our hearts. Thank you for the freedom you have given us, the awesome dignity to choose. Help us to choose well. Help us to choose right. Help us to live well. Help us to live close to you Help us to live in your mercy and your forgiveness when we choose wrong, and help us to extend that mercy to others. Father, I pray your blessing on this morning, that you would take and use this time, our discussions, our thinking, just to sow seeds in our hearts and minds, that we might be thoughtful people who can make an impact for you in our lives and our worlds by thinking wisely, depending on you, and acting well. Amen. Okay. So, Jeff, could you bring up the... That's great, thank you. Now, in the spirit of the first disclaimer I gave you, that I'm not an ethicist bootstrap, I've entitled this a very rough introduction to biblical ethics. So, ethics is the study or the attempt to define what's good and right, how to be, decide, or act morally. And as you would all know, it's not by any means limited to a Christian endeavour. Lots of people claim the right. There are many competing ethical systems and accounts of what is right and good out there in the world. Lots of us have several potentially inconsistent and unarticulated ethical systems running around in our heads at the same time. I do. So that you can hear someone over here say, oh, we should do it for that. And you think, oh, that's right. And then you hear someone over here say, but then that. And you think, oh, that's right. And you think, hang on, they can't both be, or maybe they can. So some of those you'll hear very commonly is the end justifies the means. If the consequences of this action or this proposed course of action is good, then that's fine. Others say, God said it, I believe it, that finishes it. It's the command theory of ethics. Some people just say, whatever works. It's pragmatics. You'll hear all of those out there as potential ethical models. As I was trying to say before with my Micah 6:8 example, Christian ethics is theology in action. It's based on the Bible. It's developed by the Spirit renewing our minds. That's Romans 12. God is transforming us by the renewing of our minds, sanctifying us through His Spirit, changing our character, making us more like Him. So Christian ethics is not really a list of do's and don'ts. I mean, we'll come to examples and we'll end up saying, should you, you know, sell the car, or should you not do this, da da da. So there might be a point of decision there, but it's not really a list of do's and don'ts. It's about God making us more like His Son. It's like progressing in Christian faith and maturity. So, next one please, Jeff. The goals of this guide are to sort of help us to start to develop a biblical framework for ethics, by which we can think and act and explain ourselves as to why we're thinking and acting in a particular way. And I'd like to try and motivate us to consciously engage in talking ethics with others and with each other and acting ethically in our day-to-day lives and understanding what the Bible says about better or worse ways of talking and acting. And I want to draw us back, as I keep trying to say, and I have to keep reminding myself, draw us back again to dependence on God, and not, I found a great new theory, but to be dependent on God for renewing of our minds, our characters and our spirits. I forgot a very important disclaimer when I started. Last week when I gave the sermon, I spent 16 hours in preparation in the middle of an incredibly busy week. This week I've had another incredibly busy week, and I've had about 2 hours of preparation for this. So what you'll see here will be at a quality ratio of worse than 1:8. Okay. Thanks, Jeff. There are two broad classes or groups of ethical theories. The first of all is an ethical approach to judge the rightness or wrongness of an action or a particular decision. And that's called the ethics of many names. The names are not all consistent, but... the ethics of duty is what I'm going to call it. So you focus on the action. Is that action, and you can include the motives behind the action, is that action right or wrong? Is it ethical or not? And then the other way of looking at it, the other stream of looking at ethics, is to say, well, don't think so much about the individual action. Think about the actor, the agent, the person who's undertaking the action. Is that person in their action, whatever they're doing, are they virtuous? Do they have a good character? Are they, in our context, for Christian ethic, are they displaying a Christian character? And to take an example of that, a potential example of that, which we could talk through later if you wanted to, would be a Christian businessman operating in another country where you have to make facilitation payments to get something done. Your application to get this, you know, to get a license to do this thing, a certain amount of money, a prepayment has to be made. It's not a prepayment towards anything other than if you don't make it, nothing's going to happen. And then you might have to make a number of those along the way because that's the culture of the country in which you operate. Now, that's a bribe. I mean, I'm not giving you a legal definition, but you are, in fact, bribing someone to do a job that they ought to otherwise do. And in our country, if it was done here, it would be illegal both to give and to receive that. But in that country, it's the accepted way of doing business. So we could say the act is wrong in our context with our perspective, or perhaps we shift the context and perspective and say, in that environment, with those rules, the act is all right. Or do we say, here is a virtuous person, because this person is trying to live according to Christian principles, trying to do the right thing for the country, trying to do the right thing for their company, and this is what they need to do in order to get it done. And so you assess the virtue of the person as opposed to the individual act. Mark, are we going to say something? Okay. All right, so that's just a rough distinction there between ethics of actions and ethics of character. If we then move on into ethics of actions, there's really three ways of thinking about ethics of actions. One is sort of the command theory. Something binds an actor to do a particular act or not do it. So there's some rule or authority or binding force that says you've got to do that or you don't do that, and that's what makes it right or wrong. So in a Christian context, it would be God commands that we speak the truth, or that we don't get divorced, or that we don't engage in adultery, or whatever it is, and that is the source of the ethical decision. The command from God is binding on us, so that's what makes it right or wrong. Now, people who don't believe in God can still have a command-based ethical framework. They might say, well, the law is the framework. So if the law says it's right, fine. You know, there's no need for a morality outside what the law says. So the law is the source of bindingness, and drunk driving is wrong because the law tells us it's wrong. But a bunch of other things are right because the law permits them. That's command. Second one is goal or consequence theories. Now, there's some big words around this which I've put up there. Command, deontological, it is binding. Teleological, it leads to, or its purpose or its goal is this. Don't worry about the big words. So command versus goal or consequence. So goal and consequence are related, but they're not the same. So you can try and judge whether something is right by whether or not the goal of the thing is right, or whether it's fulfilling the purpose of the particular person or activity. So, for example, the goal of human society is peaceful coexistence. If that is accepted as the goal of human society, it would follow that tolerance of all persons is right and intolerance is wrong. I'm oversimplifying this, but you see, if you start with that goal, you get to that conclusion about what's right and what's wrong. So, and you will find that. So Christians and other people of faith might run up against this because they might be talking to someone who says the goal of human society is peaceful coexistence. If you're going to be intolerant about A, B, C, and D, you're actually rocking the boat and causing problems, and you should change your mind. You are wrong. Okay. So that's goal. Second one, which you'll be even more familiar with, is if the consequence of an action is right, then the act is right. I.e., the end, in a very boiled down fashion, and again oversimplifying, the end justifies the means. So I don't want my son stealing. I've hit upon this fantastic method for stopping him stealing, which is I beat him if I find him stealing. And it seems to be working quite well. So beating him is right because it produces a good outcome. Okay, the end justifies the means. Likewise, if we eliminated the Jews or the Christians or the homosexuals or the refugees, then we would achieve our desired position of having peaceful coexistence in our society. Or if instead of eliminating, we just shut them up somehow, or shut them away somewhere, and you could think back in history, not just recent history, but more past history, that exactly this form of reasoning for the good of the society, for the stability of the state, these people need to be put away. Okay? So it depends on what is the good, and then if you're going to take a consequentialist ethic, whatever gets you to the good, is right. Okay? So you can start to see already that if you can't run all of these things together, you can run them together, but in particular contexts, they will lead to different outcomes. That's the way you think through ethical issues. Thanks, Jeff. Now, a particular form of consequentialist ethic, that is to say, the outcome, an outcome-based ethic, is classical utilitarianism. And the reason that gets a special slide is because it underlies a great deal of economic analysis and stuff that pervades our thinking. So classical utilitarianism says that an action is right if it produces the greatest amount of pleasure or utility or usefulness for the greatest number of people, the greatest good for the greatest number. That's classical utilitarianism. So morality is defined then in terms of things which people can use to satisfy their needs or their wants. It doesn't actually set out to say whether a need or a want is good, and therefore it takes no view as to whether the satisfaction of a particular need or want is good. It steps back from that and says, satisfying as many people as possible's needs or wants is what we want to do. It's up to them as to what their needs or wants are. What we need to do is just have systems that will maximise the satisfaction of needs or wants and maximise utility, as it's called. So one form of that is pleasure. If you said the main thing people want or ought to want is pleasure, if that's the ultimate good and pain is to be avoided, well, a number of consequences follow from that. We don't like the picture of people suffering in cancer wards, things like that. So at the very least, we should shut them away and not put them on TV. And we should have places where they can go to, finish off that suffering, because it's distressing to the vast majority of us to see people out there who are suffering. So it's better just to move them on. A further extension of that reasoning, and I know I'm oversimplifying, but it is very early in the morning and I've only got 35 or 40 minutes. A further extension of that is that because suffering is bad, if we start with the hedonistic presupposition that pleasure is good and pain is bad, if we can't deal with pain, if we can't stop it or ameliorate it, then it's probably best to get rid of it by getting rid of the sufferer, isn't it? Because they can't be enjoying life and we can't be enjoying life watching them suffer. So there's an argument for euthanasia. Now, I'm not here to debate euthanasia back and forth, and if we were going to do that, there'd be far more arguments you'd put on both sides of the spectrum, okay? So I'm trying to show you the thinking process behind how some of these arguments arise, okay? Rather than say, let's have a full-blown debate on any of these particular topics. Economic utilitarianism. If we go back to utility, maximising the utility of the most people, the greatest good of the greatest number, is our goal. If we put that in an economic utilitarianism sense, that means most people, we should have a free market, because the free market is the one that allows for the optimum allocation of resources according to people's wants and needs. That's true, if you're just looking at wants and needs in terms of what you can apply spending power or wealth to. But think of that in the context of free trade. Almost every economist will say to you that free trade is good because free trade maximises utility, because it maximises the efficient allocation of resources so that people can buy things. In fact, I've seen the graphs. This is an undeniable proposition. If you impose tariff barriers or non-tariff barriers on trade, you end up with a deadweight loss. You lose some efficiency and you lose some wealth from the system. Unhappily, there are sometimes, when you enter into free trade, a minority of people who are unable to cope with the structural adjustment necessary for a particular arrangement of free trade. And in fact, surprisingly, free trade sometimes seems to benefit a large number of people over in this part of the world to the detriment of people in that part of the world. On the other hand, it pulls those people out of the misery that they're in relatively, but perhaps not as much as these people over here are enjoying it. Nevertheless, we would say that overall, looking at it from a utilitarian perspective, the greatest good of the greatest number is free trade will produce more utility around the world than if we have protectionism and tariff barriers. If you are a textile, clothing and footwear manufacturer in a developed country, unfortunately, your wages will not be competitive with those of people in other countries. Your industry will not be competitive, and you will have to change your job. And, sorry? If there is one. And yes, that's called structural adjustment, and that's where the government has to step in to help you to do that. And, yeah, okay, so you're 50 and you're stubborn and you don't want to change. Well, that's, you know, just... That's unfortunate, but the greatest good of the greatest number. We're not saying everybody's going to be happy, we're saying the greatest good of the greatest number here. Right? Now, you could see that a Christian ethic might have something different to say than the greatest good of the greatest number. Or at least we wouldn't ignore the people who are not in the greatest number. Okay, thanks, mate. So if with that, I was talking there about the ethics of acts. If we think about the ethics of virtue, which is the name given to the theory that you don't look at you don't focus just on whether the act is right, but you look on the actor. The idea here is you should examine the character and disposition of the actor and not the action. So, and there's plenty of biblical basis for that, where the Bible would extol character virtues such as compassion, kindness, gentleness, hospitality, generosity, peacefulness, truthfulness, humility, forgiveness, and forbearance. And while you could apply those to individual acts, you can also apply them and say, is that a godly person? Is that a godly person acting, not perfectly, because none of us ever act perfectly on this earth, but is that a godly person who's acting broadly in accordance with the nature of Christ, which has been born in him or her and is being developed in him or her by the Spirit? So assessing the actor rather than just the act. Next one, please, mate. In fact, if you look in the Bible, you will find moral material which runs across, which appears to be endorsing some the ethical views of saying something is right, either because it's commanded, either because it's consistent with the purpose of the thing, or it's consistent with consequences, i.e. you look at consequential reasoning, or character approaches. What that suggests to me is that, well, like, Christian ethics is complex, life is complex, ethics is complex, but probably some sort of balance of all of the approaches is needed. So we don't want card-carrying consequentialists who don't pay attention to purpose or command. We don't need card-carrying commands who don't pay attention to purpose or consequences. We need to put them all together. Okay? In this good book by Michael Hill, The How and Why of Love, An Introduction to Evangelical Ethics, he goes through the different theories, and he comes up with a sort of a master theory. I mean, when you're an academic, you've got to propose a master theory. So his... I'm not being facetious, just the mindset. It's a difficult problem you're trying to resolve and come out with something. His master theory is this. He suggests that the kingdom ethic is an ethic of mutual love relationships. So an action or a trait of character is right if it creates or maintains mutual love relationships between God and humans, or between humans and humans. Okay. Sit with that for a moment. An action or a trait or a character is right if it creates and maintains mutual love relationships between God and humans, or humans and humans. Now, a lot of thought's gone into that. May not be perfect, but an awful lot of thought has gone into summing that up. It's certainly got the first two elements of Micah 6:8 in there. I think almost implicitly it's got the third one about walking humbly with your God. All that could be made more explicit, that we're not going to get to this and do this unless we are walking humbly with our God. Yeah, mate. Yeah, I think he's coming back to that, isn't he? That our actions must be creating or maintaining mutual love between God and humans. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind and strength, and love your neighbour as yourself. And then help other people to love God and help other people to love their neighbours. That's what this ethic's saying. So are our actions or our character traits facilitating these. I think it's not a bad definition. I wasn't being facetious when I said it, but I think it's not at all a bad definition. Could we have the next slide, Jeff? We also have to realise that, remember, that we live in a fallen world. We're fallen, or we're still sinful, even though we're redeemed, and God is sanctifying us progressively. There's still sin in us when we're flawed people. And we live in a world that's fallen, and we're going to run into other flawed people, and we're going to run into other people who have no necessary agreement with the types of ethics which we find in the Bible. So we may have to retrieve as much good as we can in a situation rather than finding the absolute fulfilment of Hill's mutual love ethic. So, for example, I'll just read you this one. For example, imagine a spouse is married to a person who wants to leave the marriage and establish a relationship with another partner. No matter what the spouse does, the partner is determined to leave and establish a new relationship. And nothing the spouse can do will stop the fracturing of the marriage. Separation or divorce is not in accordance with the oneness that is the purpose of marriage. That's going back to a purpose ethic. What's the purpose of marriage? So from Genesis 2, cleave together for life. And in the context where hardness of heart prevents the accomplishment of the goal of mutual love, love would seem to necessitate the retrieval of as much good as possible, or at least the reduction of as much harm as possible. So the justification for canvassing a retrieval approach is found in passages like 1 Corinthians 7, where Paul allows that an unbelieving partner can leave the marriage if that is his or her wish, so that hostility might be avoided. And Paul's words there are, God has called you, the remaining partner, to peace. These words stand in stark contrast to his earlier command to Christian couples that they not separate. In passages such as this one, and the logic of living in the now but not yet, drives us to the conclusion that Christians have to operate on both the mutual love ethic and a retrieval ethic. Is retrieving as much good from situations or minimising harm as much as we can while we wait for the consummation of all things. So where Christians cannot bring the perspectives of the kingdom and mutual love relationships into play, the ethic seems to be to do as much good as possible. Now I have, that would commonly be phrased, in fact I'm guilty of phrasing it this way, sometimes saying, well, it's the lesser of two evils, do the lesser of two evils. But as Hill rightly points out, Christians aren't here to do evil. It's not the lesser of two evils. We should not even say that or start thinking about that. What we're trying to do is the greatest possible good. So what's the greatest possible good that we could do in this situation? What's the greatest possible good in terms of an outcome that we could achieve? Okay. All right, that's the theory. I think that's the theory. What's the next slide, Jeff? Yeah. So I've got a few case studies, which are just little examples, and I'd like you to maybe break into groups of three or four. Doug, is that what we do? This one, I'll just read it through to you. I'll ask you to just take 5 minutes to discuss it. It's a pretty classic one. You and your friend don't have much money. You can be young and students. You can be old and pensioners. You could be unemployed. I don't mind what age you are, but you don't have much money. But your mate is going off to Asia on a great Christian mission opportunity, and he asks you to sell his car while he's gone. The proceeds are really crucial to meeting the expenses of the trip and his other debts while he's gone. So it's important that he gets a good price for this car. But he has to go, so he's entrusted it to you. Now, you know the car has some significant rust issues in the chassis. But those aren't apparent on a general inspection. You actually have to get under the car and have a good poke around to observe the rust. So you're there, you've advertised it online or in the trading post or whatever, and buyers, prospective buyers, start to turn up. What do you tell, if anything, answer could be nothing, what do you tell a prospective buyer about the condition of the car if they ask nothing about it? If they ask the general question, is there anything wrong with this car? Or they ask you if you would buy the car? Or they just happen to be the senior pastor at your church? Would your answer differ in any of those circumstances? So, I'd like you to think about what you'd say, if anything, and you can say nothing, that's all right, and I'd like you to think about why you'd do that. So can you just break into groups of three or four and just work that through. So what would you do and why would you do it? All right, can I just take you somewhere else, guys? Because we're going to have to wrap up quite soon, so this will be the last thing. But I just want to read you an extract. Can we have the next slide? Jeff, which doesn't tell us much, but we probably won't have time to discuss this, but let's see. I'm going to read you an extract from this book, which is actually it's a good book called Beyond Integrity, which is a business ethics case book put together by some Christian business professors in the States. And this is the idea. The idea behind this is that when you operate in the business world, the ethics you operate under are game ethics. Not church ethics, but game ethics. A respected businessman with whom I discussed the theme of this article remarked with some heat, "Do you mean to say you're going to encourage me to bluff? Bluffing is nothing more than a form of lying. You're advising people to lie." I agreed with him that the basis of private morality is respect for the truth, and that the closer a business person gets to the truth, the more he or she deserves respect. But at the same time, I suggested that most bluffing, which may be a deliberate misstatement, which you know to be untrue, but you're doing it with a view to getting the other side to up their offer or move away from a course of action or whatever, or increase your salary or whatever the scenario is. I suggested that most bluffing in business might be regarded simply as a game strategy, much like bluffing in poker, which doesn't reflect on the morality of the bluffer. And I quoted Henry Taylor, the British statesman, who said, "Falsehood ceases to be falsehood when it is understood on all sides that the truth is not expected to be spoken." An exact description of bluffing in poker, diplomacy and business, he said. Now, I'm not reading this to you as truth, I'm just reading this to you for your provocation and enjoyment, okay? I cited the analogy of the criminal court, where the criminal is not expected to tell the truth when he pleads not guilty. Everyone from the judge down takes it for granted that the job of the defendant's attorney is to get his client off, not to reveal the truth, and this is considered ethical practice by the attorney. I reminded my friend that millions of businessmen feel constrained every day to say yes to their bosses when they secretly believe no, and that this is generally accepted as permissible strategy when the alternative might be the loss of the job. The essential point, I said, is that the ethics of business are game ethics, different from the ethics of religion. My friend remained unconvinced. Referring to the company of which he is a president, he declared, "Maybe that's good for some businessmen, but I can tell you that we pride ourselves on our ethics. In 30 years, not one customer has ever questioned my word or asked to check our figures." So he's appealing to his honesty. "We're loyal to our customers and fair to our suppliers. My handshake is my bond. I've never entered into price-fixing schemes with my competitors. I've never allowed my salesmen to spread injurious rumours about other companies. Our union contract, our labour contract, is the best in the industry. And if I say so myself, our ethical standards are the highest." My friend was really saying, without realising it, that he was living up to the ethical standards of the business game, which are a far cry from those of private life. Like a gentlemanly poker player, he didn't play in cahoots with others at the table. He didn't try to smear their reputation or hold back chips he owed them. But this same fine man, at the very same time, was allowing one of his products to be advertised in a way that made it sound a great deal better than it actually was. And another item in his product line was notorious among dealers for its built-in obsolescence. He was holding back from the market a much improved product because he did not want to interfere with the sales of the inferior item it would have replaced. He had joined with certain of his competitors in hiring a lobbyist to push legislation in the state parliament by methods he preferred not to know too much about, into amending a law which was then going through the parliament. In his view, none of those things had anything to do with ethics. They were merely normal business practice. He himself undoubtedly avoided outright falsehoods. He never lied in so many words, but the entire organisation that he ruled was deeply involved in numerous strategies of deception. Now, I'd just like you to think here, and I think we're going to have to wrap up in a second, aren't we, Doug? I'd just like you to take... we've got 5 minutes, so maybe think for 2 minutes. Think about your experience of whatever business world or other organisational world you've operated in, and think, is there Two questions. Is there in practice a line? Is there a very limited view of ethics so that ethics is we're honest, we don't tell deliberate lies to other people, my handshake is my bond, that sort of thing. But ethics is not what we pay our labour force. Ethics is not whether our advertising might be slightly misleading. Ethics is not planned obsolescence in our products. Ethics is not necessarily some of those deeper justice type things in respect of communities, customers, stakeholders. So do you observe that, and is that right? Or is that too limited a view of what ethics requires in your business or your workplace? And the second question for you to think about is the one sitting in the extract I've read. Is the ethics of business really game ethics? Nobody actually expects me to... I mean, every day I come in and they say, fantastic, how's it going? Is business going well? I say, absolutely, boss, no worries. Things are booming. I'm thinking, yeah, I hope that sale comes through by Friday. You know? Do we play a game? Do we have a role? You know, wear a mask, play a role. We have to do that sometimes. But when does that mean that the operation of most of our lives in business or in the workplace means that we're operating on a game ethic, which is way dissimilar to the ethic that we'd apply in our private lives or in our church life? And how do we live with that? How do we put those two together? Is that okay to have that divide? Or do we need to say, well, I actually need to change some of what I do in the business, employment, public space to make it more aligned with what I do over here in my private family, Christian church, morality and ethics? And they're very deep questions. I don't expect you to come up with an instant answer, but you might just want to talk about them for a couple of minutes in your groups. Gentlemen, can I just call your attention back? We're at 9:25, so I don't have time to sort of have a feedback session on those difficult questions which I just asked you. But I hope that my hope and my prayer for this session is that this is for some of you this may already be, but it's for many of you it's deepening this question in your minds of I have these values and this ethic and this understanding of who I am in Christ and the way I should live, and yet I go into those environments there and there where an entirely different set of ethical assumptions and frameworks is operating. How do I live as a person of integrity, as a Christian, operating in those environments? Do I just say, oh, this is game ethic, so hat off, hat on, and operate there? Or do I try to operate as a Christian and think through what is a wise response to this situation so that I can live as a person of integrity? You may remember that last year we had three guys get up and talk about that. I don't think any of them are here this morning, so I'll embarrass them by saying it. You know, Mike Petering, Andrew Wade, and Mark Cassinis got up and talked about exactly that issue, about how in a business environment, they tried to apply their Christian ethic in a world which is going to operate in quite a different ethic, in a way that was not necessarily well regarded by their peers or their superiors, but they did it because they knew it was right and because they're acting out of the virtue, the ethics of virtue. That was their character, that was who they were in Christ, and they were trying to bring that in a wise way into the workplace. And what I hope I've done this morning for you is to, and me, because I need it as much as you, is a nudge here to say, are we doing that? Do we need to do that further? How could we do that? And I remind you again about the four studies from the Centre for Applied Christian Ethics, because this is a conversation we've only scratched the surface of this morning, and I think there's a lot of wisdom in the room, a lot of experience, and we could take this further. So if you're interested in doing that, I can certainly point you to it. You can find it on the CACE website. You can go to Ridley CACE. You can pull it off yourself. Or as I said, if you'd like to be involved in a small group doing that, then I'd be happy to work on a small group like that for 4 weeks. So thanks for your time. Thanks for coming this morning. I'm going to hand it back to Doug to close.